May I remind you that in this first section, our goal is to try to come to an understanding of how those who actually knew Jesus thought of him at the time. And all the lectures we've done up to now have been very interconnected, related to the idea of Jesus the prophet, the teacher, the awaited one, and hence the Son of Man, the suffering servant, the way he was making God's word revealed to people. Tonight we take a step into a related but can be quite a different concept, and it's the idea of Jesus as the Christ. I note there for you that Jesus is called the Christ over 500 times in the New Testament. So that by the time the New Testament is written, it's almost like a second name. As a matter of fact, we still use it like that. We talk about Christ or Jesus Christ almost as though it's his name. We've forgotten that it's a title with meaning almost. So we're going into a fairly rich area tonight, and I want to do it in two sections. Before the break, I want to look with you at the meaning of the word, firstly, what it may have meant at the time, and then after the break, we'll see how Jesus was understood as the Christ in his own day. Well, let's begin with the word and its basic meaning. And I'll try and get the real feel of it for you, if I may. The English word Christ comes straight from the Greek Christos. That comes from a Greek word krio, which means to anoint with oil. We have the word chrism for that oil. So, and that's exactly the same as the Hebrew. The Hebrew word Mashiach, or however it's pronounced in Hebrew, but something like that, we often put into English lettering as Messiah. That word also comes from a Hebrew word which means to anoint with oil. Then, obviously, the word Christ means someone who's been anointed with chrism, with oil. Why would one anoint a person with oil then in the Jewish or Hebrew kind of world? I think the key concept behind all of this is the concept of holy. Holiness. We need to get that really clear, lest we miss what Christ means. The text that might be familiar to you from the prophet Isaiah, which we'll actually look at a little later this evening, is in the Isaiah chapter 6, is his vision in the temple. It's the year of the death of the king, and it was very troubled times in Judah. And the king that died had been reigning some 40 years and was an excellent organizer and so on. His death was like the end of an era and spelt terribly troubled times for Judah. The Assyrians were coming in and so on. And it was in that year of his death that Isaiah, in the temple, presumably praying, had this vision of the king, the great king, God, reigning and his glory filling the whole earth. And then he goes on to say, around him were these seraphs, these mythical creatures, and they were crying to each other across the sanctuary, "Holy, holy, holy Lord Yahweh of Sabaoth, of the stars, of the heavens. The heavens and earth are full of your glory." That word, holy, the Hebrew kadosh, means something like transcendent, other, mysterious. And it's a word that's only used of God, and I'd like to really stress that with you. Only God is holy. It's a word kept absolutely for him. So that no person can be holy, no place can be holy, no thing can be holy. There's only one possible object to be predicated holiness of, and that is God, Yahweh. The implications of that are, which I suppose you can see, that if a place is called holy, and they were, a sanctuary was a holy place, it had nothing to do with the place, but it had everything to do with the fact that God is there. If a place is holy, then God is in the place. That's why it's holy. If a person is holy, and this has, I think, profound implications even in the spiritual life, talking about holiness and so on, which we often do, if a person is holy, it has nothing to do with the person. It has everything to do with the fact that God is in that person. Now, that has implications for the person's moral life and everything. I'm not denying that. But holiness, strictly speaking, is only for God. Is that okay? The point is really important. So let's draw out some implications of that. As that Isaiah text says, the heavens and earth are full of your glory. So the Jewish understanding was that the whole world is a sanctuary in that sense. The whole world, because the glory of God fills all of it. But in fact, God manifested his presence, or so they interpreted their experience, in certain places, at certain mysterious, prayer-filled times. And one of the loveliest texts, which you'll have to go back to simply because the literature is so beautiful, is in Genesis chapter 28. And it's the dream of Jacob, which you kind of, can't read too often, so lovely. Jacob, who will later be called Israel, so he's kind of the one after whom the whole nation is named. This Jacob reached a certain place, unnamed, and he's passed the night there since the sun had set. Taking one of the stones to be found at that place, Jacob made it his pillow and lay down where he was. He had a dream. A ladder was there, standing on the ground, with its top reaching to heaven, and there were angels of God going up it and coming down. And Yahweh was there, standing over him, saying, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. I will give to you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants shall be like the specks of dust on the ground. You shall spread to the west and the east, to the north and the south, and all the tribes of the earth shall bless themselves by you and your descendants. Be sure that I am with you. I will keep you safe wherever you go and bring you back to this land, for I will not desert you before I have done all that I have promised you. Beautiful text, isn't it? Then Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, truly, Yahweh is in this place, and I never knew it. He was afraid, and he said, how awe-inspiring this place is. This is nothing less than a house of God. This is the gate of heaven. And now the point I'm reaching for, rising early in the morning, Jacob took the stone he had used for a pillow, set it up as a monument, pouring oil over the top of it. He named the place Beth El, House of God. I'm fairly confident that the key sensation behind it, not totally sure of this, but I think the key sensation behind it is an olfactory one. It's to do with smell. It's to do with, I keep thinking of that song, You Fill Up My Senses Like a Night in the Forest. Lovely thing, isn't it? Annie's song. It's something of that, I think. The perfume of God, this perfume of the oil that's poured, beautiful aromatic oil, permeates the place and is a symbol of the presence of God. Like you might get the presence of roses in a room in the morning if you open up and they've been locked and they're breathing during the night and you get that lovely perfume or whatever, or jasmine or something outside your window. Well, God's presence is like a perfume permeating the place. And this very sacred place is flooded with this ointment, this unguent kind of... And the anointing or the consecration is a symbol then of the holy place. Well, God, of course, as I said, is in the whole world, but there were certain places that were consecrated. That's one of them, Bethel. It's the first we know about. And then you find the tabernacle was consecrated, the temple was consecrated, and so on, various places where God historically manifested his presence. That was a special holy place. Well, similarly then, with the people, all the people were the holy people, because these were a people, the people as they understood, the people of Israel, that God had shown his presence to, had kind of taken as his own, chosen as his own, the chosen people, and loved in a special way. So they saw themselves as holy. And please note, holy doesn't automatically mean good. You see the difference, I hope. It has demands of goodness, but holy means God's there. Now that has implications, how we should live. But holy is simply a gift given by the Holy One. And you'll find, for example, Exodus 19, verses 4 to 6, a beautiful text at the end of the desert journey. You've got these people going right through the desert from, and they're up on a mountain. This is the Mount Sinai. And what a lovely image it is. God says to the people, "I carried you on eagle's wings." And you can see the eagles in the desert, eh? "I carried you on eagle's wings and I brought you to myself. All the earth is mine. I will count you a kingdom of priests, a consecrated nation." They're all holy. But let me continue. In a special way, again, while all the people were holy, certain people... And I want this concept, if you can, to be really clear, we'll come back on it in a later lecture, were taken out of the people. Because I did explain earlier that holy means other, transcendent. And so the holy place, the tabernacle, had to be outside the camp to demonstrate that God, we can't go close to God, the transcendent one. He can kind of come close to us through his angels and his word and his spirit, but the Almighty. So when they built a tent for him in the desert, they made sure the tent was well separated from our tents. So there were certain people who were well separated from us, the ordinary people of the village and whatever. And they were called, well, our word for it is priests, so that's a rather complex word, but they were the sacred men, the holy men, the consecrated men, and they were taken out of the people and anointed to care for the sanctuary where God had manifested his presence. Leviticus 8:10-12 is one of many texts. Moses took the chrism and anointed the tabernacle and everything in it to consecrate them. Then he poured the chrism on Aaron's head, consecrating him by unction. That concludes my first point with you. The Christ is, if you're talking about a person, the Christ, I think, is essentially the priest. And I don't mean priest as you understand the word, or in my own case, called a priest. It's not that concept, it's a different one. It's one whose duty is to tend the sanctuary away from the people and represent them with God in the holy place. Which is not my function, I hope you realize. So, that's the priest's place, to be where God has manifested his presence, where the Holy One is, and devote his life to the caring for worship in that holy place. Okay? Let's take it a little bit further. Other people were called consecrated people, or Christs, in the Old Testament, namely the prophets. I won't delay on this because we've done a lot on prophecy already. The prophets were men, women, either, though the ones that come down to us with the great prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, etc., were all in fact men. But so the Spirit of God could come down on and select and choose and make his presence particularly manifest in a particular individual, like Elijah, like Jeremiah, like Ezekiel. And they spoke God's words. So they too were anointed with the Spirit. In fact, Isaiah 61:1 reads, "The Spirit of the Lord has been given to me, for God has anointed me, chrismated me, and poured the perfume of his Spirit, breath, perfume, over me." Psalm 105:15, "Do not touch my anointed ones, do not harm my prophets." Elisha, in 2 Kings 4:9, is called the holy man of God. I hope you can see that word holiness coming in again. And then the 1 Kings 19:16, Elijah is told, "You are to anoint Elisha as prophet to succeed you." So it seems that the prophets also were anointed for the similar reason, that they were people who, in whom God had manifested his presence, and so this would be ritually demonstrated by the perfume of the chrism. And now I come to the third and major point that's going to take me right through to the break with you. The third group of people, and in fact historically and from the point of view of the literature, the main focus of attention is on the king. Because the king was meant to effect God's reign in the world. The king was the one responsible to see that the sanctuary was tended. He was the one who had to make the holy place a proper place where God, for God's chosen people. He was the one, by his laws, by his wisdom, when he went through the land, the perfume of God was meant to go with him, because it was God's kingdom, not his. He was simply the instrument, the vehicle, the vase holding the perfume, as it were. And you, I've got texts there for you, you'll find them easily enough in the books of Samuel. You remember when little David was found, how the prophet Samuel took him and anointed him, poured chrism over him, and that's it. He's now the king. You can't touch that. He's consecrated by that overpouring of oil. And so on with Solomon, taken down to the virgin spring, the spring of Gion, down which was the main spring where water from Jerusalem came, and was anointed there by the prophet, and then taken up into the throne and enthroned and so on. There are some lovely texts that I'd like to just meditate with you on and help you perhaps read them as I do. Just to see if you can get some closer feeling tonight as to how the people of Israel looked at the king, ideally, what they expected of him, what kingship was meant to be for them, and why he was anointed and seen as the vehicle of the Holy One in the land. Here, Psalm 89:20-34. "I have selected my servant David." And that psalm would be for David and David's son and grandson and great-grandson. They're all David, just by being king. And the dynasty of David. "I have selected my servant David and anointed him with my holy oil," which means he's a Christ, an anointed one. "My hand will be constantly with him. With my faithfulness and love, emet chesed," the two words used of God right through the Old Testament. Here they are again. God's fidelity to his covenant. "With my faithfulness and love, his fortunes shall rise. He will invoke me, my Father, my God, the rock of my safety. And I shall make him my firstborn son. I will keep my love for him always. My covenant with him shall stand. I have founded his dynasty to last forever. I will never withdraw my love from him or fail in my faithfulness." a psalm that picks up the promise of God to the holy people, the consecrated people, the holy land, and the one in whom all these hopes are vested, that he will ensure it, keep it, and by law establish it, and so on. Another most important text that we're going to come back to in the second half of tonight's lecture is the so-called Oracle of Nathan. Nathan was the priest that attended David. And it's in the second book of Samuel, chapter 7, verses 12 to 14, and would be one of the key texts of the Old Testament for tonight's reflections. And the text reads, and I'm highlighting for you, the three main points that were attached to the king. The text reads, "When your days are ended," that's David, "and you are laid to rest with your ancestors, I will preserve the offspring of your body after you and make his sovereignty secure. It is he who shall build a house for my name, and I will make his royal throne secure forever. I will be a father to him, and he a son to me." Right back in one of the very early lectures, when we looked at Jesus, the Son of God, you mightn't recall, but I noted with you there that there are only three texts in the whole of the Old Testament where any individual is called a son of God, because it's dangerous in the mythology surrounding them. They could get the wrong idea. And the son in those three texts is the king, and he's the son not from birth, but from consecration as king, to make sure that there's no kind of mythological imagination of God being the father, as it were. I've already looked at one of the texts, Psalm 89. Here's the second one here again. And this was a special, intimate relationship between the consecrated king and God. So he's the father of the king. The king is the son of God. Secondly, the dynasty is forever. The expectation would be that it would last forever. And thirdly, the function of the king is to build a house for God. That's a real key element right through. It still is. And the only time I've ever been to Jerusalem some years ago, I remember talking to a very impressed there by a certain rabbi man, or highly educated Jewish man, and I think he was a rabbi. And I was fascinated by the fact that the temple, there's no temple in Jerusalem, but a mosque. And I wanted to know his feelings at that fact, because I thought, you know, he might feel awkward about that. He was totally pleased that it was a mosque. Totally pleased. Because it's a holy place, it's kept away from everything else, it's something to do with God. And I said, but wouldn't you like a temple to be there? And he said, that's nothing to do with me. He said, the Messiah will build the temple. No one wants the temple to be built. The temple will be built when God wants to build it, and that will be by the Messiah. And when the Messiah comes, the temple will certainly be built. He's got no doubts. But you see what he's holding on to this still in the 20th century. That's the task of the Messiah, to build the house. Not him or the army or the government or anybody else. Okay, so those three concepts I'll come back to later in the night. But there they are in that attached promise, intimacy, permanency of dynasty, and the task of building the house. Still on the king, and I'll be on it for a little while with you. A couple of texts to, I hope, help you grasp some of the significance of this. This is an extraordinary psalm, Psalm 45, 6 to 7. It's unique. There's one other text I'll show you later tonight that I think is related to it, but it's practically unique, where the king is even addressed as God, which is a bit of a shock to us. And I'm not totally certain. The text is a little bit difficult to be absolutely certain, but the obvious meaning of it, the obvious reading of it in the Hebrew, I understand, having traced it right back, and the way it is used, for example, in the New Testament, in the letter to the Hebrews, it certainly accepts that psalm is calling the king God, and it applies it to Jesus, the risen Christ. We'll see that another time. But God means, El is the word for God in Hebrew, it's Semitic languages, and it means the powerful one. So it's an association of the very word of the Almighty. The king is like the Almighty on earth. And therefore, in a daring text, they can call him God, not saying he's a God separate from Yahweh, you understand, but he's the kind of almost like the incarnation of the God, which is a really daring and brave image. And here it is. Your throne, they say to the king, your throne, O God, shall last forever. Virtue you love, wickedness you hate. That is why, O God, to the king, your God has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your rivals. The king is the anointed one with a task to make effective the almighty power of God on earth. And now, very important text for tonight's concept. In the Jewish understanding, a priest, as we looked at earlier tonight, had to belong to the tribe of Levi. That was the way it had to be, and priesthood was hereditary. If you're a priest, your first eldest son was a priest. Younger sons would be sacristans, Levites, kind of looking after them, but the eldest one would be a priest. Just because he was the eldest, no reason he's got the job. And that's the way it was. The king, of course, was of the tribe of Judah. So the king couldn't be a priest. Just absolutely impossible to be a priest. But because of the sacredness of his task, there's this lovely text here which associates the king with the priesthood in a very simple way. Let me read it to you and then explain if it needs explaining. It's Psalm 110, 1-4. Yahweh's oracle to you, my Lord, the king. Sit at my right hand, and I will make you or enemies a footstool for you. You plonk your foot on them and keep them under. Royal dignity was yours from the day you were born. On the holy mountains, from the womb of dawn, like dew, I have begotten you. Beautiful, isn't it? Imagery. Yahweh has sworn an oath which he will never retract. You are a priest of the order of Melchizedek and forever. The king. Melchizedek, if you look up the book of Genesis chapter 14, was hardly known character who was the king of the city that would later be captured by David and called Jerusalem. And Melchizedek was the king and was also a priest, and he offered bread and wine there in one of those ancient sacrificial acts when he met Abraham centuries before. Eh? So this figure, because the king now is the king of Jerusalem, he is a priest like Melchizedek was a priest, not like the Levitic priesthood. But that helps link the king in with all the cultic imagery and all the sacred sanctuary kind of feelings that human beings have about the presence of God. Is that understandable to you? All those texts, of course, mean a lot to us because of the reference later to Jesus, but that's what we'll look at later. For the moment, I'm trying to just feel with you into what a king was for the Jews. Well, that's the end of that point. Now I want to take you through a little bit of history, which will take us a bit, we'll start working towards Jesus. Their general concepts. Now, more particularly, in the 8th century BC, King David was 1000 BC, just to get a date. So a couple of hundred years after King David, and at the end of King David's reign, his son Solomon became king in the 10th century. When he died, the kingdom split up. A much more truthful way of looking at it is the northern kingdom was the main kingdom. I mean, the northern kingdom was the whole of Samaria and Galilee, and that was the good agricultural land and the fishing in the lake and down along the Sharon and the coastline. That was basically Israel. Judah was down in the hill country, pretty rugged hill country round Jerusalem, though Jerusalem wasn't owned. David, when he took over by force and became king, he had the clue of building Canberra, like, you know, get somewhere that nobody owns, a high peak, make it the centre, and then Canberra isn't a good analogy, but he made it out of nothing. So he made Jerusalem there, which was neutral ground, and tried to unite the whole thing under him. And the people in the north thought, well, who the hell are you, you great upstart? Who do you think you are, you know? And so he managed to hold it by charismatic power and military might. His son Solomon held it, but straight after that they just said goodbye to them. And while most of our literature, because it comes from the Judahites, or the Jews, would give us the impression that the Jews were it, they were absolutely it, most Israelites would have thought of the Judahites or the Jews as, so what, you know, uncultivated mountain people from the desert kind of country. So why did I say all that? Not sure. Well, in the 780s and so on, Assyria, Ashur, one of the main cities on the Tigris or Euphrates, I can't remember for the moment, had been growing in might during this time. It was the first great empire, I suppose, of the world. And Assyria was gaining more and more power, and Assyria, if you know your geography, is, you know, well, the Tigris and Euphrates go down to the Persian Gulf, and then over this way is the Holy Land. And they were gradually coming and taking over Syria, which is Damascus, and moving in, and that was a period of great tension in this area, and they'll sweep right down and conquer Egypt and take the whole area there. Well, the effect of this is what I want to watch with you on Judah, where the kings are, the king David and his descendants. And this is the time of the great prophets, Isaiah particularly, and the minor prophet Micah. A few things here I think are interesting in view of looking at how Jesus could be the Christ. The first thing I want to draw your attention is what I mentioned earlier, the death of King Uzziah in 742, after a long period of stability in Judah, the southern area around Jerusalem, and consolidation of that part of the world, he died. And because by now Assyria has been growing in might and the northern kingdom is about to fall, and it is, poor little Jerusalem was really frightened by this. And there is the text, which you've already looked at, of Isaiah's opening vision on the year of the king's death. And what he sees is God the King reigning through the whole world and filling the sanctuary. Again, the spiritual ideas of temple and holiness are there. And the holy, 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 his glory fills all the whole earth. My eyes have looked at the King. That's the beginning of Isaiah's reign. Three other dates, which you can't really hold in your mind, but I want to draw to your attention here during the time of Isaiah, from 742 to 700, Isaiah was effectively prophesying. He was a powerful man, seems to have been a court advisor, among other things. 40 years he was kind of holding the country together spiritually, and when you read Isaiah, you'll realize why he did. A marvelous religious spirit, and some of the events that were troubling his kingdom at the time, 735, Syria, which is Damascus, and Israel, which is the northern kingdom, worried by the fact that Assyria, the great empire, is about to swamp them. They were trying to get Judah, to come in with them and form an alliance, a military alliance against Assyria. But the great king had died, Uzziah, and now in 735 a new king came on, a young man called Ahaz. It was his just beginning, a prince and then king. And they thought they'd take the opportunity, since Judah wasn't coming in on it, to force them. So they went down to try and get rid of Ahaz and put their own puppet king on the thing and to build up their defences. That was in 735. And King Ahaz, the young man frightened about what was going to happen, thought he might call on Assyria, to come in and defend him. And this is like today's history, isn't it? I mean, bring in America or Russia or somebody to kind of... And you're going to find Isaiah telling the king not to do this, not to trust in chariots, not to trust in the great, powerful nations, because if Assyria is brought in to defend Judah, Assyria is not going to leave, mate. They're going to take you over. Like politically astute as he was mainly interested in faith, as we'll see. 721, 14 years after this, King Ahaz, by the way, ignored Isaiah, did call the Assyrians in. In 721, the northern kingdom fell. Samaria was besieged and the whole northern kingdom fell. So it's just about to collapse themselves. And in 701, there was a threatened siege of Jerusalem by Sennacherib. You've probably read some of the poetry of Byron, isn't it? Sennacherib came down like a wolf on the fold or something. That's in 701. Again, Isaiah is still there telling the king that not to have dealings with these people. In fact, that siege did not happen because a plague broke out, and also there was a revolt back, a palace revolt, and they withdrew their troops. Now, that's a bit of historical background. Now to the faith content of Isaiah through that last part of the 8th century. Three things I want to draw your attention to. Isaiah and Micah, the two prophets in Judah, called on the people for faith in the King, Yahweh. Isaiah 7:9. And I put the Hebrew there just to see the beautiful play of words. You can probably just see it by looking at it. There's a lot of lovely poetry in the background that the English can't capture. But if your faith is not sure, says Isaiah, your throne will not be secure. Ta'aminu and te'amenu. A pun on the words. Both of them coming from the word amen, which we use in English, which means trust, faith, fidelity, emet of God. So they're to do with security and where you put your trust. Isaiah 30:15. Your salvation, says Isaiah to the people, to the king he's addressing, the key, is in conversion and tranquility. Your strength is in quietness and trust. I'm probably doing this a bit rapidly, but interesting, I was in Melbourne at the beginning of this year, and a man whom I have great respect for, Jeff Lacey, whom some of you know from when he was at University of New South Wales, a marvellous layman, marvellous faith man, and he was saying the same thing about our own condition today. And why he's so violently anti-nuclear, whatever it is for the same reasons. He says, "Look, we've got to. Our faith is not in chariots and horses. It's not in nuclear deterrent. If our faith is in God, then surely that will be the most powerful faith condition for the love and will of God to be done. That if it is possible to avoid a nuclear holocaust, the only way is going to be through the love of God. And so we have to put our faith in God. However illogical, however perhaps even stupid from an organisational point of view that may appear. Whatever of that, that was certainly Isaiah's view in his day when his world was on the verge of collapse. Here, Micah 6:8, contemporary of Isaiah. This is what Yahweh asks of you, only this. To do justice, do it. To love with compassion, chesed. And to walk humbly with your God. Having faith in God is faith in Yahweh. Yahweh the Redeemer. Yahweh who took us out of Egypt. Yahweh who will not allow his promises not to be fulfilled that he has for you and for the people. And Isaiah is saying, put your trust in him, which means do justice. Be effective. The king's job is to bring about the reign of God in the land. And if he does justice, if our governments were doing justice, then that is the way to let the liberator God in. And you know this other text, I'll put it there again, just to play with the Hebrew a bit for you, Isaiah 5:7. Yahweh looked for justice, but found bloodshed, for righteousness, and found a cry of distress. It's a very moving, very relevant, very modern verse. And just to show you there, he looked for, I can't pronounce it with accuracy, but I can give you the feel of it. Yahweh looked for mishpat and found mispach. He looked for zedaka and found Ze'aka, if you can feel the Hebrew. P playing on the words, but the close relationship and yet the total difference between those words of what was happening and what the prophet is saying must be done. So the first point that Isaiah is making of the king and of the what's meant to be happening, the political leaders, is to have faith in Yahweh. The second theme of Isaiah is reminding the people and the king that God's promise of fidelity, which we've already looked at in Nathan to David and the Psalms, we've looked at that promise, God renews it, and it's going to be through the king. And here are two texts that you're familiar with. But put in the context, they then have their own meaning.